Hi, everyone. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story It's Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that they see underneath.
That's right. That's what we do. And this is episode number 33, The Wrath of Khan.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And we have a guest.
Yes. Very special guest.
Mm-hmm.
Are you there, guest?
I am behind door number three.
Heather Ordover from Craftlit and Just the Books.
And welcome. That's fantastic.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I am so excited to be here.
That's great. That's great. So, you're from, say again, Craftlit and Just the Books, right? Just the Books is fairly new.
Just the Books is fairly new. We've taken the Craftlit feed, and I say that it's all the lit and none of the craft. We've just removed the crafty talk and left it to the book chat.
And what's the book you just started?
We just now started Gulliver's Travels.
Right.
Because in our current political climate, knowing who the Yahoos are seems to be a useful piece of information. And there are so many Yahoos.
Sadly, so, everywhere we look,
it's true. Don't have to look far.
Yeah, but I listened to the first episode and it is really wonderful. Heather, you did such a great job of pulling out all this wonderful basic information to get us started. So,
oh, thank you.
Oh, that's cool. Yes. And I have downloaded it, but have not yet heard it. So I apologize, but I am going to. As soon as
I
we're
don't
done here.
Mind a bit. Yeah, right. Because you don't have anything else you need to do.
Not at the moment, huh?
No, it's a marvelously modern story, not unlike many of the stories that will come to play while we talk about our stories tonight.
Yes.
The Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan.
You guys need like a gong crash behind
there's
you.
There's so much goodness in this. There's Star Trek. There's all these other things, too.
There's Ricardo Montalban's chest.
That's right.
And his wonderful crazy eyes and his crazy 80s hair.
Hair.
Yeah, he looks like he could be in a band.
It's true.
I know. I think it was, I didn't go back and watch the episode it came from, but I think he was supposed to be maybe Native American or hippie-ish or something. I mean, he was
Indian, I thought, from India.
He was what?
Indian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that explains the hair.
So, so Khan comes from the first season of Star Trek, the original series,
an episode
called Space Seed. Yeah.
It was really the first season.
It was. It was episode 20 something. I actually called it up. Episode number 22.
Wow.
Written by a fellow named Cary Wilbur. The Enterprise discovers an ancient sleeper ship, the SS Botany Bay, which escaped from Earth's eugenics wars in the late 20th century. The genetically engineered passengers, led by war criminal Khan Noonien Singh, seize control of the Enterprise and attempt to destroy the ship. That's the description.
That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And you know, it was great because we watched it with my 11, almost 12, and 8-year-old just recently. And one of the first things I said was, okay, why is it called the Botany Bay?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah.
And my 11-year-old knew.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh,
and that's when I thought, you know, Fairfax, Virginia educational system, score one.
Bravo, bravo.
Damn.
Bravo.
That's
cool. So the, as I understand the story, Harve Bennett, who was, well, first of all, we should probably say, why aren't we talking about Star Trek One?
Yeah, I was going to say maybe or tell about the movie.
Yeah.
Crazy, but
Star Trek One, yawn. Let's move on.
Yeah.
No,
Star Trek 1 was one of those complete misses. I mean, it cost, what, $40-something million to make.
Yes.
And it was like they took Star Trek and they took almost all the humanity out of it and made it into this 2001 type of very serious movie. And that wasn't the audience. I mean, they completely missed it.
There was very little respect for the fan base, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. They, I don't know what they were doing, but to me, they were making 2001 Part 2. I mean, the special effects shots just went on and on and on. Look how cool we've done all this stuff. And and Spock was so serious. It was awful in so many ways.
And the funny thing to me was, I mean, it was this very respectful treatment. And Star Trek was, you know, like Wild West in space, kind of. I mean, or, you know, Horatio Hornblower in space. It was about adventures and, you know.
Yeah, and the trouble with Tribbles. Yeah. I mean, there's a sense of humor to Star Trek that
matters.
There definitely is.
But to me, Star Trek has always been, and I am a fan. You know, I watched these growing up, the original series. I loved them. And the story, it was always about Kirk, Spock, and McCoy.
To me,
it was those three guys and how those three men related with each other that made the stories so excellent. And then, you know, out of the 79 or so, there's probably a third of those episodes that were really excellent. And those three in those stories are what really made it tick. And it's amazing that this guy, Harv Bennett and Nicholas Meyer, who were not Star Trek people. Isn't that right, Julie?
Yeah, they'd never seen it.
And they watched all these episodes in a big fat hurry, and they realized this show is really about these three guys and how they relate to each other, you know?
Yeah, Harv Bennett got brought in. And he sat down and watched them all and picked out the space seed. They say it's the first time a movie has ever been made as a sequel to a TV episode.
Wow. Yeah.
And maybe the only time. And then he gave it to somebody to write the script. And then at the very end, Nicholas Meyers got brought in and he wrote The 7% Solution with Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. And that was the first spinoff story, I think, like that. I remember when that came out and read it and everything. So I think he was the perfect person to look at it and go, okay, what are the essential elements that you want to retain? And the script they had was very serious again. And he's like, no, humanity, these three guys, and, you know, let's make it a little less reverent.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when you know that he's also the guy who does Time After Time and takes, you know, another kind of a historical story, but then he overlays the whole H.G. Wells kind of mythology on top of it. I mean, Nicholas Meyer was the perfect guy to come along and rescue the Star Trek franchise because he gets story qua story, but he also gets storytelling in a way that is very literary, which is what we've kind of been talking about behind the scenes as we were preparing for recording.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of what's at the, I think part of what's at the heart of the whole Wrath of Khan, because the rest of the movies were fine. The rest of the Star Trek movies, they were fine. There are whales. That's fine.
That was another
Khan
comedy, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. But this is the one that everybody goes back to and they're, oh yeah, but Khan.
And think about it. This movie is like something like 30 years old.
Yeah.
You still have to pay for it on Amazon to stream it, by the way. $3.
Wow.
It's not free with Amazon Prime, I'm just going to say.
No, and we had to download it off of iTunes on to stream for us, too. And we went ahead and shelled out the $3.99 for the HD version.
Well, I don't want to brag, but I've got the Director's Edition 2 DVD set right here in front of me.
Dude, score!
Score!
Well, and, you watch
some of these interviews on the disc number 2 from the 80s, and I tell you, the suit Leonard Nimoy wears in this interview is astounding. And I'll send you guys a picture of it.
I can't wait to see it.
It's astounding. But
well, we watched our old videotape, which didn't translate as well as it could to the flat screen TV, and I came away from it going, I have got to get a DVD of this because I'm going to watch it many more times.
Yes, for sure.
That was my feeling too.
And also I was looking around for what different people said about some of the depth to the story, and one of the people had watched it and wrote a very complex review of it. He watched it for Good Friday this year.
Wow.
So that's how interesting. People keep relating to it.
That's fascinating. Yeah.
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 So we still haven't talked about the movie.
Yeah. One more tiny bit of pre-story, I guess, is Leonard Nimoy did not want to do this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. He, like happens to many actors, right? He's Spock. Yeah. and everybody knows him as Spock, and he has trouble finding work doing other things that interest him. And he was at this point thinking, I need to be done with this. I really, really need this behind me. And he had to be talked into it.
And he was saying this, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, and it was Harve Bennett who wrote, you know, that original script. And he went to Leonard Nimoy and says, hey, what if we kill Mr. Spock in this movie? Will you do that at least? And he said, well, maybe write the script and show it to me. And he wrote the script, showed it to him, and he was like, I don't know. And then they brought Nicholas Meyer in, and he met Nicholas Meyer, and Nicholas Meyer said, I will rewrite the script and have it back to you in a flash. And he did, and he read it, and he said, you know, I think I'll do it.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness. Yeah. So, but yeah, he details all that. I read his book, I Am Not Spock, a long time ago. A while back, and it's interesting. You know, I really respect Leonard Nimoy a lot.
I
love listening to his interviews, and whenever he talks about stuff, I find him to be a really intelligent, worthwhile guy.
And eventually he embraced Spock, as we know.
He did again, In fact, by the time this was over, he felt that they had done such a good piece of work that he could see this continuing. And he began to think there is merit in Star Trek based on this movie.
Wow.
And he again started to think at the end, the original cut of the film had, well, we better talk about the movie. Original cut of the film stopped a little bit earlier than it does now. And they added the end, basically with Nimoy's permission, because he became open again to the possibilities. And they added the possibility at the end. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So fascinating.
That's great.
As Mr. Spock would say.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yes.
Okay. So the movie. let's see. It opens up Spock and Kirk. I don't know how many years after the original series this is, but Captain Spock is now teaching at the academy, and Kirk is an admiral. And he's feeling his middle age, not too happy about it. Yeah, it's his 50th birthday.
That's right.
And Mr. Spock gives him a book for his birthday. And what book does he give him?
A Tale of Two Cities.
A Tale of Two Cities, right. Which I have not read. And I'm really excited to hear both of you tell me what, you know, Julie told me that it's really entwined in this story. And now I'm excited to read that book. It never occurred to me to read the book before. But
Julie harangued me in the best possible way.
That's very kind of you.
I always give you credit for this because I publicly, in front of God and everyone, disparaged this book on Craftlit 100 years ago and said that I had read the first chapter, the first two chapters, the last two chapters, and I got an A on my test in freshman English, and gosh darn it, but that was all I was ever going to read of this bloody book. And Julie, I think you must have emailed me while you were listening and said, you need to listen again. You need to try it. I promise you, you're not going to regret it. And so because Julie's Julie, I paid attention.
So dang
and
pushy.
She's right.
I have to thank LibriVox because I had finished Uncle Tom's Cabin and said, I'm going to try another classic. I'll try Dickens. And I think that had just come out or it caught my eye. And I listened, and I was able to get through it listening in a way I couldn't when I was reading. And it was when I was sitting at my desk working, listening to the very end, and I burst out into tears.
Yep.
I was like, wow, this is an amazing book.
Yep. And I had the same thing happen. I spent the last 15 minutes of the audio sitting in my car in the garage with the engine off going. I was so unattractive. It was just spectacular. It's what Dickens had been hoping for.
Oh, wow.
So when he's given that book, I suddenly read A Tale of Two Cities. I was interested because I heard it had a lot of Moby Dick in it, and I could kind of see that having ever read Moby Dick. But and then you, Scott, were like, I was wanting to talk about Star Trek. So it was a perfect storm.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so he gives him that book. And then in the meantime, Chekhov and his captain are on a ship called the USS Reliant, and they're out cruising the universe for a planet with absolutely zero life on it in order to try out this thing called the Genesis device, which if they blow it up on a planet, it just transforms the planet into a life-bearing planet. So they come across this planet that they think will work, and Chekhov and his captain beam down, and whoops, but Khan lives there now. And he treats them very badly.
I think that's a lovely way to put it.
He's pretty upset. He says, you know, yeah. Chekhov's like, oh no, we put you down on a nice planet. He's like, this is the same planet. No one ever came back to see if I was okay.
Yeah. Have you seen Space Seed, that episode?
I remember it because I watched it so long ago.
Yeah. So at the very end of Space Seed, Khan, who's this genetically engineered guy from the past, almost defeats Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, but of course they win. And what do? They don't bring him back to the Federation. They just put him on a planet, you know, where it has no civilization or anything on it. They just drop him off.
And then kindness, because he'd be in prison if they brought him back.
Exactly.
Well, he got to choose, right? I believe, because that's
one of the books on his bookshelf is Paradise Lost. Okay. You could be right.
That choice.
Lucifer would rather rule in hell than serve in heaven.
That's right.
And I think that's a quote they use at the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm. I should have watched the episode before this
podcast. Well, I read something, so
I apologize. Khan! Yes. But you're right. I think I recall that moment where he does decide that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this woman who helped him try to take over the Enterprise, she goes with him as well.
Yeah.
Who you assume is his wife, because he's talking a lot about his wife when they find
brother.
Him.
Yes. Yeah. He was pretty upset about that.
He was upset about that because she died on this planet.
Yeah. And like any good sociopath, he would not have remembered that he had a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he's the one who decided this instead of prison, this kind of prison instead of that kind of prison.
Exactly. And he shifted it to, oh, Captain Kirk left me there, but he never came back to see that something happened that blew up the other planet and shifted our orbit and made us into this desert-like hellhole.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Yeah, so this whole Khan thing is just because they crossed paths. There's nothing Kirk could have done to have not gone through all this.
Right.
You know, just because that's the way Khan was, right.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. So, okay. So now Khan has the USS Reliant. Him and his people that are left on the planet, they all beam up to the Reliant. Now he's got control of that ship. And Kirk and Spock and McCoy and a whole crew of youngsters are on a training cruise in the refitted USS Enterprise. And they get a message from the people that are running this Genesis experiment, and who is someone he used to be involved with, Dr. Carol Marcus.
I heard
that Kirk had a girlfriend or two, but I wasn't sure till this film.
Mostly green.
They were usually green, yeah. She was blonde and blue-eyed.
So. Yeah, well, what's interesting in this is that they didn't choose to pick someone from the original series, because I don't recall her and I looked it up, and she doesn't exist in any of the other shows.
Mm-mm. Okay.
Yeah, that was an odd choice, but because they had so many to choose from.
Well, I think what they were trying to say, that they were trying to say that she was actually from a more mature relationship instead of him kind of gallivanting around the universe.
You think it was before or after the 5-year mission?
After the 5-year mission, that she was actually an adult relationship, and it was a decision that they both made, because they have a conversation later in the movie.
Yeah, they do.
It's a decision they both made that this isn't going to work, because she has her science and he has his stars, and
that's right.
Those two things aren't going to work well together.
Yeah,
says, I did what you wanted. I stayed away.
I stayed away.
Yeah.
Yep.
So he was willing to try to settle down or come see her a lot or whatever.
Right.
Or willing to say that he
made that connection. That's good. Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, so the Enterprise, again, receives this message, and it's a very odd message. So they decide, hey, let's go check it out. So they go to check it out, and the Reliant is also on the way, because Khan has learned about the Genesis device from Chekhov and his captain, and he decides that would be something that would be very cool to play with.
So I'm sorry, Scott.
That's all right. And they meet on the way there, or they kind of converge there, I guess.
Yeah.
And they have their first confrontation.
Just awesome.
Dun, 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 yeah. dun, dun, dun,
I know.
Dun.
I could hear that.
Complete with red shirts.
Reliant. quoting regulations. Yeah.
That's right.
My son even said at one point, who is that who died? And I said, he's a red shirt. And then I realized, oh, my son doesn't know what I just said to him.
Yeah. Well.
Code. Yeah. Secret code.
Now
sweetheart.
When he watches Galaxy Quest, he'll understand.
Right.
I don't want to.
So, because the Reliant is coming and they aren't answering anything, and they're like, this is damned odd. And young female Vulcan who never acted as Vulcanish as I thought she should. But anyway, Kirstie Alley is like, well, you really should be raising shields. It's like, oh, shut up. It's a Federation ship. And then Khan opens fire.
Yeah.
And it's very bad.
Fire. We're one big happy fleet. Yep.
I have to say, I'm more in love with Ricardo Montalban than ever. Just the way he's ironically, of course they do not have shields up. We are one big happy fleet. And you're just like, oh, you're so evil. I love it.
Taking advantage.
And he's
trusting people.
Yep.
Let them eat static.
Yep. Gotten a little careless.
That's
Captain Kirk has.
Put in that for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, and Captain Kirk's kind of worried because he it was his 50th birthday and he was feeling old. And McCoy says, it's like a museum here. You have all these old things.
Yeah. Why is your birthday like a funeral?
Yeah. So you feel like this is the first time you might have gotten out in a while. So he's a little rusty, possibly.
Right.
And then Captain Spock's back there going, shut up, Ensign, or whatever she is. The Admiral knows what he's doing. And they're all sorry.
Of course they are.
Yeah.
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 Yep. And then Khan fires on him when he's close enough and does a lot of damage.
Kills a lot of people.
And, it was also really nice because my sons noticed that the opening gambit of the Kobayashi Maru test, which I thought was a brilliant, brilliant way for Nicholas Meyer to start the movie.
Oh, yeah.
That opening gambit, if you are a special effects junkie like I am, you notice, before you know what's going on, you notice that the special effects are wrong. Because there's smoke and there's flashes of light, but there's no flames. But then later, when Khan really hits the ship for real, those flames are actual flames, and they are awfully close to some of those actors. And Heather got a little nervous. But it's marvelous because it is a perfect movie in so many senses, but in that special effects sense as well, that they are telling you the story visually as well as textually. And it's one of the things that we've all been kind of tagging onto. And that hit from Khan, that sucker hurts.
Yeah.
People get hurt. People get really badly hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating. Now I need to
and
watch it again.
Kirk's pride is hurt because now they're going to all die thanks to him.
That's right.
That's right. Yep. And then they meet for the first time. And it's interesting in this movie that they never have a scene together. Ricardo Montalban and William Shatner never in the same room.
It's all busy screen. That's true.
Yeah. I wonder if they actually showed up to help each other if they were talking to a wall. I'd be interested to know that.
Tell Shatner.
What's that?
How can you tell with Shatner?
That's a good question.
Oh, did I say that out loud?
Yeah, we're all thinking it. I love Captain Kirk, but he is what he is. And
he's a marvelous
subtle actor was not one of those things. He was out there for the big action.
Yep. Okay, so let's see. Then Kirk figures out how to turn the tables and manages to fire back on Khan, who has to run because now... he's flabbergasted at how the guy did it in the first place. So he says, I've got to get out of here because I don't know what happened. Plus I can't shoot back at the moment.
They've disabled me.
Right.
Somehow.
And then, Kirk goes down to not down at this point. He goes to the place where they're building Genesis, which is an orbital, space station science station thing. And everybody there is dead except for his, the mom of his son, his ex-girlfriend or whatever. Oh, yeah. I don't think they ever were ever married. And then, they realize that they beamed down somewhere inside this moon that they're, orbiting. So they decide to go there and the Enterprise leaves. I don't know how detailed we want to go through all this, but the, anyway, when he's down there, he meets his son for the first time.
Yeah.
There's a big cave down there that's been transformed with life due to this Genesis technology. And, then
it is a Garden of Eden.
And it is a Garden of Eden. Yeah. And, then there's this really cool bunch of dialogue between Kirk and Khan, the most famous part of the film, where he tells Khan that he keeps missing his target. He says, "You managed to kill everybody else, but not me." But it is all on the radio, and and he says, "All right, I've done more than that. I'm going to hurt you really bad." And he beams away. Khan beams away the Genesis device, so he takes it, and he's going to do some serious damage with it, and leaves Kirk to just rot in the middle of this moon, he thinks.
Yep.
So then, any discussion there? Because that's the famous Khan moment.
Khan. Well, I know, because he's so, but that's the first time you see him. I mean, you've seen him flustered and you've seen him sad and this is the first time you've seen him just pissed off. Okay. Yeah. He's like, "Well, you just managed to get everyone but me. You keep missing the mark," you know, and he's delivering these wonderful lines. But then when he goes back to trying to, "No, wait, you want me. You've got to come back and get me." Crap, he took the Genesis project. All of a sudden, there's no chemistry. It's too bad. Khan's like, "No, I'm sorry. This isn't working. Yeah. I'm leaving."
Yeah.
No, it's like the 7-Eleven test. It's like he walked him into the 7-Eleven, saw what he was really like, and said, "You know what? I'm just taking Genesis and I'm out of here." And how do you react to that? You get ticked off.
Yep. That's right.
No, it's marvelous. But it's also I think it's one of those moments that goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the first Star Trek movie having lost the heart of the Star Trek genre, which is we care about each other.
Right.
And what's their mission? Their mission is to seek out, all that stuff. But really, it's about saving lives and doing no harm. And here's Khan, and he's like a teenager in some really nice Victorian tea parlor who's just smashing stuff around because he doesn't know how to behave. And Kirk's like, when he says, "You know, you're killing everyone except me," you can see his ire rising. That it's like, you know, don't go after the weak ones. Don't go after the people who can't defend themselves. Go after me. At least make it a fair fight. And that's one of those things that we tend to respect. I think one of the things that people tend to respect about Kirk, as much as we make fun of Shatner, I think it's one of the things that we love about him too, is that we buy that. We believe him when he says those things.
Yeah. And one of the moments that I really love in this movie is right before that first confrontation with Khan, you know, Spock says, "Hey, it would help me to know what Genesis is." So he brings Spock down to his cabin. And then who else does he call but Dr. McCoy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is he calling in, you know, some scientists or whatever? He's calling in, you know, this is the three, you know. And that moment, you know, I just love that those moments in all of Star Trek when, you know, there's all these moments where Spock and McCoy argue and Kirk watches them. And Kirk is formulating his decisions based on watching these guys argue, and he trusts them both. And it's just a fascinating dynamic to me. Yeah, and I don't know what else to compare it to, but it's always, it's always just a central part of Star Trek.
Well, because Kirk is he's more emotional and everything, but he's also smart. But McCoy always represents kind of the moral outrage of when things are wrong. You know, it's that old country doctor thing he likes to put on. But, you know, he's like, "Oh, great. You know, it took God 6 days to make the world. But now, guess what? We can destroy and create one in 6 seconds, you know." And so he's pointing out the implications here.
Yeah. Shouldn't we think about this before we build it? Who's doing this stuff?
Yeah. You and know? It's already well, done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this moment is also one of the ones Nimoy talked about it in his different writings that he's done on having played Spock. But this is one of those Talmudic moments when it is absolutely in keeping with Nimoy's personal background to have that kind of impartial observer watching an argument and going back and forth between the logical sides. There's an emotional logical side and there's a logical side, but all of this information is important. And it is only through respectful argument that you can really get to the heart of what's at stake.
Yeah.
And this is why you have so many Jewish lawyers. Hmm. This is how you're trained. You're trained to debate and argue and come to a conclusion, a logical conclusion, but one that is also ethical and fair.
And
these three men do that all the time.
Never thought about it from that point of view, but that is really good because that's the kind of thing that we see. Of course, we being Catholic, you know, Jesus does it all the time. He's constantly turning the questions on other people and asking a different question. Mm-hmm. But you see it, of course, all through the Old Testament. It's Abraham going to God. Well, but if there's 40 people, are you still going to, you know, let's talk about it, Sam. Let's think it through. going to destroy them. And I hadn't thought about it from the point of view of that. Is it Judaic? Is that how you'd say it? Or Hebrew tradition of you let everybody have their say and talk about all of it so you can get it all out there.
Get it all out. Yep. Yep.
Fascinating.
And I think too, that kind of passionate debate is something that is often frightening to people because of the passion that it can raise. Mm-hmm. But that once you're past it and everybody's had their say and been heard, then everybody's calm again.
Yeah,
and then you can go, okay, well, wait a minute. That thing you said, that thing was important.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back and look at that.
Yeah. Yeah. And the decisions can be made at that point.
Yeah. Because my Catholic stepmom and I were just talking about the money changers in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And that for her as a child, seeing Jesus in that scene is a shock because he's really ticked.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes, he is.
And with every good reason in the world, but to see that kind of passion from someone who is supposed or so often referred to as, you know, a lamb, and he's very patient and he's very kind, he's very generous. Remembering that passion is there because of the ethics.
Yeah. It's directed at what matters.
Mm-hmm.
That anger is there, but it's only for the things that matter, which is true respect for God.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just thinking about the fact that that's an interesting point because we are so wired for story anyway. Mm-hmm. And the arguing in Star Trek, the episode, moves the stories along for one thing. It's a quick way of going, well, there's this, there's that, there's this, there's that. Here we go. We're going to do this.
Exactly.
And in the movie, of course, it's that same dynamic. But in terms of our lives and how we debate things and decide things, that serves the same purpose. It moves those stories along and puts all those points out there so we can go, oh, okay, and choose it and go on. I hadn't thought about that connection between that kind of thinking and storytelling.
That's a really nice way to put it, Julie.
Sure is.
Oh, thank you.
Heck yeah.
Well, I was kind of actually thinking about Goodreads, somebody had reviewed this book, and I think I mentioned this before, Scott, but it was a different review, but by the same person, where he was talking about, well, I just don't understand Christianity and blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
Well, this conversation in the comments boxes has been going on for probably 2 or 3 weeks. It gets picked up every so often. And sure enough, today got picked up again. There were 252 comments in there this afternoon.
Wow.
So many different people all commenting about religion and why do Christians or people of faith think this about God? And then the atheists are chiming in and everybody. But I have never seen the main people. And I, of course, was one of them because I just can't keep quiet when that's going on. I'm like, well, this is how we understand it. But it was respectful It was good humored. There were people would laugh and joke with each other about stuff that I didn't see one instance. I could have missed some, but I didn't see one instance where people were screaming and yelling and stomping off or being mean. And usually when you see that many comments, somebody's really mad, you know, and
that's so hopeful.
Yeah, it sure is.
So happy.
Yeah. I mean, at the end, the atheists were saying, well, now if Richard Dawkins could just talk like this, everybody was laughing over that, you know, like, why does he have to be so rude? Look at this conversation we just had, all these things we talked about.
Yeah.
And we're all still friends. So
that's cool.
That is very nice.
So that's be done, just like Spock, McCoy, Kirk, you know, they're friends at the end. So,
Well, and they go to the mat for each other all the time and nowhere more than in Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, Scott, did you tear up?
I'm teared up right now.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I need a moment.
He's a little beclumped.
Did you bring a Kleenex?
I sure did. I'm all right.
Good.
Luckily, Kirk still gets to beat up Khan. So,
that helps.
You bet. So let's see. They talk a little bit more about the no-win scenario when they're down there too.
Yeah. Well, the Kobayashi Maru, that was something that was referred to in the regular show, right?
I don't know that it
I don't know that it was.
It was introduced here.
Yeah, I'm not absolutely positive, but I think that that's true that it was introduced here.
I'll check.
Yeah.
Because it was the beautiful, it was the perfect idea of, well, and we're clearly into spoilers, you know, if you haven't seen this movie, it's 30 years old and we've already told you more than half of it. So, you know, but,
there it is. I was going to say, yep, there it is. That's the good part of the movie.
Well, but now I forgot what I was going to say. It's that Kobayashi no-win scenario. It's that thing of, I was talking to Tom tonight, and I just suddenly went, you know what? You really don't connect until the end when you're thinking over the whole story and character growth that, you know, it starts off. And the reason, of course, that Captain Kirk is the only one who's ever won the no-win scenario, which he tells Savick, Lieutenant Savick, or whoever she is at the beginning. Mr. Savick, you're right. Mr. Savick at the beginning that it's a test of character. And you suddenly realize he's failed this test of character all these years. It's like watching Odysseus or Coyote or one of those suddenly come up against an immovable wall. You have to face death. You can't win. What do? You know?
Yeah.
And he sits there twisting his hands and what time is it? And I have to say, for all the things I've said about William Shatner, and I'm sorry, William Shatner, I do love you, actually. But the way he sat there in that chair, so nervous, his legs were crossed, his arms were crossed, he was very tight, his kind of almost tapping his foot is, what time is it? And then he'd glance at his son, who'd just shake his head and go, no, that's not enough time. We can't get away because they can't fix the engines before Khan blows up his ship and destroys them all.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
That was beautifully done, I thought.
It was. And then, you know, while that's happening, Khan is giving his Moby Dick speech.
Yes.
To a wall, I guess, because
from Hell's Heart.
Yeah, from Hell's Heart, I spit at thee, right? He's saying this, and no one hears him. And no one hears him, you know, but he's just saying it.
Isn't that more or less true of Ahab too in the book?
It sure is. Yeah.
Oh, you've read Moby Dick? Okay.
I have. I have read Moby Dick. You know, my favorite line in Moby Dick, I looked it up. It's not quite as I remember it. But it says, he piled upon the whale's white hump the sum of all the general rage and hate felt by his whole race from Adam down. And then, as if his chest had been a mortar, he burst his hot heart shell upon it.
Ooh.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've heard that before, but wow.
Yeah, and the part that I remember, I thought it went, if his chest had been a cannon, he would have shot his heart upon it.
That's how the kid's version.
Is it? Okay.
Oh, okay.
So I have heard that somewhere before. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Khan is doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That man can rat, I tell you what.
Oh. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and there, because there was a line in there, and I kind of looked a little, but I didn't see it. And it said, you know, I'll follow you around, you know, something's nebula and this and round partitions bend before I, you know, stop. Mm-hmm. And I thought, surely that's from the book. I couldn't find it. But if not, what fine writing, because mm-hmm. it sounded just like it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it sure did.
And that's when his cohort is going, no, you've got everything. You're throwing it all away.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Don't do it. So Kobayashi Maru does appear for the very first time in Khan. It's okay. been used since then. And interestingly enough, in Japanese, Kobayashi means small grove, and it's a family name. Huh. And Maru is the suffix for a ship. I went on the Nippon Maru when I was a child, and it was in port in San Diego.
So if it's a family name, I wonder if... Mm-hmm. It's a tribute to somebody.
That's what I'm wondering too.
Yeah,
isn't Mr. Kobayashi the one in The Usual Suspects?
I've never
played
seen
by Pete
it,
so Pete Postlethwaite.
Well, I don't know.
I know, it's on my list. Many people have told me yes. That's good.
Yeah.
I say nothing except I know a guy who knows the guy who wrote the movie.
Oh, wow.
You are so connected.
I know, right? And it does me nice. No good at all.
Well, you sound very important when you talk to people like me who know no one. So,
do you like that? I can probably say, you know, I know someone who knows someone who went to school with the Indigo Girls kind of thing. I can do a lot of those.
Well, if I cared, but sorry. You just lost me. Moving on.
All right. Okay. Next.
Well, so which brings us to, right, the part we... Did we all cry because Mr. Spock is smarter than everyone as always and goes, okay, it's the line that they say at the beginning. Well, there's two lines they say at the beginning.
The needs of the many.
And one is how we deal with death is at least as important as how we deal with life, which is the point of the Kobayashi Maru, which is ironically said by Captain Kirk, who's never had to do it. So he lightly tosses this off. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is, what is it? The good of the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or
the
one.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to say, we watch Spock go off and sacrifice himself and die. And I cried. I was surprised. I was not crying quite like a baby, but close.
Good enough.
But I was thinking about this later, and I was like, we've just come through Easter, and that's almost what Caiaphas says as the head priest in the Gospel of John when they're going, this guy just raised Lazarus from the dead. We're never going to be able to stop him. The Romans are going to crush us. And he's like, no, that's it. We got to sacrifice him. And that's when he says that line. And in my Bible, and Heather, you may know this, it says that Jewish belief was that the head prophet or the head priest could say prophetic utterances even if he was unaware of them.
Really?
Because that's how it's presented in Catholic teaching, is usually that even though he was against Christ, God used him to say something that was very important for us to all know.
That makes sense.
Everybody always remembers that.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. It's, you know, it's one of those things that's so hard to know as far as, I mean, we're Jewish, we're Reformed Jewish, but we're
okay.
Historically interested people who are not made uncomfortable by Orthodoxy or conservative Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting because the split between the pre-temple Judaism and post-temple Judaism is so monstrous. Yeah. That whatever really happened in the temple pre like 72 AD, it's so hard to find consistent information. So sure, that makes perfect sense to me.
it worked for our telling of the story. I'm just saying, okay.
No, well, and I think that there are it's important to allow that to happen. It's, you know, the out of the mouths of babes thing. It's prophecy and import and words that matter show up all the time. It's the important part is to hear them.
That, well, and that's the thing, and to kind of consider them. And so that's the, but these two things are constantly, I mean, they're brought up two or three times, you know, because at the end, Kirk's son brings up to them how we deal with death is at least, mm-hmm. or does he say it the other way, how we deal with life? Does he flip it on him? I can't remember.
I can't remember now either.
But the line gets brought up again, and that's when he's being rejuvenated in spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I don't know if I can now bring up my Tale of Two Cities epiphany or...
Yeah, please do.
It's not like
I'm still... I'm at this point, you know, we're pretty much through the movie, and I still don't have any idea what a Tale of Two Cities has to do with it.
Ah.
Because doesn't Kirk quote Tale of Two Cities again right there where he's at this moment where he's feeling young?
Yeah.
Isn't that the moment you're talking about?
Yeah. And let me... I printed out the first paragraph of A Tale of Two Cities because Heather will know it better than me because she went through it with all the Craftlit people and I was listening and everything. But there's something about having to do that research and talk about it yourself that burns it on your soul. But it was when when Spock is giving him the book and Kirk, I think he flips it open. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And he goes, "Are you giving me a message?" And he goes, "Oh, well, none that I'm aware of, except, of course, happy birthday." But A Tale of Two Cities, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven. We were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received for good or for evil in the superlative degree of comparison only. And it wasn't really, and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And then it gets to the end and I'm watching the end. Kirk's sitting there. He's picking up A Tale of Two Cities. He's going to read it, and he picks up his glasses, and I'm thinking, why did they put this scene in here? And Tom suddenly says, "Oh, look, he's almost done with it." Well, it's a huge book, and I'm like, "Oh, really? How much time did he have to read on this trip?" And then I suddenly went, "Holy moly, he's almost done! It's the end of the book. It's a message for us." And then he looks at his glasses in disgust and puts them down, and one lens is broken, and I'm like, and he doesn't need his glasses anymore because he was blind like in Amazing Grace, but now he sees. Spock has taught him the real meaning of life and of facing the no-win scenario is you cannot be afraid of death. It is the sacrifice you make for others that makes life abundant and full. And so when he looks out, the thing with The Tale of Two Cities is everything is doubled. It's all in comparisons. It's about London and it's about Paris. It's about, what was that guy's name? Charles Darnay and Sidney Carton, who looks almost like him, but they're very different in personality. But they both love the same girl and all this kind of thing. Well, I don't want to spoil the book for you, but I don't think it will. But at the end of the book, there's a huge sacrifice. And as Kirk says... he reads Sidney Carton's line, and it's, it's a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done before. I can't remember it exactly.
Far, far better rest that I go to than I've ever known.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's talking to somebody who's in line with him, and he says, well, I really believe that I'll be resurrected and I'll go to heaven. And I was reading about A Tale of Two Cities, and it says the original title was Recalled to Life.
Mm-hmm.
So... for me, just at the most superficial level of the doubling, and it takes us from the beginning to the end of A Tale of Two Cities very deliberately, I was like, well, he's basically looking at, let's look at the kind of man Captain Ahab was and the Moby Dick scenario, where he's just going for revenge. This is the point of his life. And then let's look at Sidney Carton, who has lived his life in a very reckless, careless ways a lot of the time.
Mostly with green women.
Yeah, mostly with green women whenever he could get them.
Mm-hmm.
And but he makes a big sacrifice at the end for a woman he can't have,
mm-hmm.
but who he loves dearly. And In fact, he substitutes himself for somebody else in order to do this so that person can have her. So he's making a giant sacrifice. And I'm like, this whole story is about what gives you abundant life. Does this make sense, everybody?
It sure does. I'm nodding at the microphone.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I'm nodding, and I'm filtering right now because I'm going, okay. There's something, because here's, and I suppose it is kind of the Jewish take on it. So when he picks up Tale of Two Cities at the end, I saw that it was at the end of the book too. And so in my head, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's the Sydney Carton scene.
Yeah.
And when he puts on the glasses and has to take them off again because they're broken, my reaction is, oh, the cruel irony of fate. He's going to have to figure out the end for himself.
But he quoted the line, so he knew the end.
Right. But that's not the last line of the book.
Oh, okay.
That's almost the end of the book. And so if he got as far as Sydney saying that, The last passage is that gorgeous pastoral, and I'm not going to be able to remember it by heart, but it's this, I see Paris and I see the fields and I see the future spreading out in front of me. And it's this beautiful thing. And it's, if you can't read that yourself, then my hope for Kirk was that if he couldn't read it himself, he could see that anyway, that this sacrifice that happened, this amazing gift that Spock gave everyone, gives him that chance at that future. Whether he can read it in a book or not, that's what his life will be. And he's the one who's going to write that future for himself. So there's the cruel irony of not being able to read the end of the book, which as a literary person, I find like, oh, but it's the last words. And then as just a human, you kind of go, oh, well, it's open. It's available. And it's for you to make happen now.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I was looking for Tale of Two Cities, looking for the last paragraph. And the last thing it shows is him saying that line. So
really?
It's missing part of it, whatever I was looking at.
No, I could be remembering it
backwards. Oh, I believe you. I believe you. I was just looking. But the thing is he does realize it because he's looking at what the Genesis Project did, which is new life from lifelessness, except he changes it. He doesn't say life from lifelessness. He says life out of death. It brings life out of death. Actually, this is the second version I found. This is Read Book Online, and the very end is, it is a far, far better thing.
Oh, no, you're right. It is.
The last passage is him saying that. Yeah, he is talking, and he's saying, I see this, and I see that. I see. He's stopping the doubling.
Yeah.
You know, here's the conclusion.
Oh, that is so interesting. Interesting that I flipped that around.
But when I looked at that, and there are other things that are deeper, and maybe, you know, I mean, I had one page for notes in my little book here, and I was like, I am not even going to use half of this. And it's so scribbled, and I was trying to fit so many things in because I was like, oh, there's so much here, I can't get it all. But all that contrast between him and Khan, of course, is what makes it a great story, because as people who've grown up on story, we know what should happen. We know who's living the unprofitable life. And it's pointed out several times when his, you know, second in command keeps going, sir, you've got it. You've won already. Oh, shut up. I haven't either. He tasks me. I will have him. It's like, I'm going to get everything I want. And it's his pride. And Kirk is proud, but he's not so proud. He can't see a lesson when it's in his way. And he's more, to me, he's just more emotionally driven. I mean, Khan is too, but with a point. But Kirk is just kind of out there. And I loved the way also to come back to the series that, you know, you watch the series and rewatch it as I did too, Scott. You never stop to think about, no one's following behind him, making sure all the stuff he just cavalierly tosses off works out. So he's faced with a whole life of careless decisions. You know, no one ever checked on Khan. Well, you know, and I can't blame him, but still. Who are all these women he's been messing around with? well, here's the results of one, and it's a son who hates him.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I did what you wanted. I stayed away. But did he ever think about it any more than that? Is that really what should have happened? Mm-hmm. Did he try to talk? I mean, you know, so it's the unexamined life. He's paying the price for that. And he's, well, but because of Spock, he doesn't need those glasses anymore. He's got that. I'm sorry. Now here I'm going to go all Catholic on everyone. Super Catholic. You know, he's got that new life, that new sight that an encounter with God brings you. It's He's the new vision. Lens that's put in front of you that changes your whole life because it changes everything you see. You see it in that new light. And that's what's happened to him. That's why I feel young.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a particularly Catholic thing, though, because that, I mean, that goes back to Old Testament too. It's a faith thing because it's the wrestling with angels. You come out of the night when you wrestle with angels and you have a new name.
And it may injure you. You may limp. Right. The rest of your life, but you don't mind.
No, yeah. Because you can see it. Yeah. You can see it for what it is. Right. And what an opportunity. What a gift.
It's the necessary price that was paid for that knowledge.
Right.
Because you wouldn't have understood it. Yeah.
There was something else you were saying about, the thing with the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Did it strike either of you that the relationship with his ex whatever and his surprise son, there were, aside from the hairdos, there were just a few moments that screamed time capsule to me. And the relationship with the son, the fact that he even says, "I stayed away like you wanted," I was like, wow, is this what, 1984?
Yeah.
That this, and not
he didn't
only
even
that,
know what he looked like,
but not only that though, but the duality, the best of times, the worst of times.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of a regardless of which side of the political fence you were on, that was a very polarizing time because it was either you loved what was happening in the country or you were very sad about what was happening in the country. And I heard living where I did, I heard people arguing both. It was like being at Wimbledon. Mm-hmm. And I remember very, very clearly watching that moment in 84? When did this come out?
I think it was 84. I think you're right.
45, somewhere around there. And 42. Thinking, this is political. Wasn't 82 V'ger?
No, I think 79 was V'ger.
Oh, well, then
1982.
Yeah.
It was. Ooh, I was a young thing.
No, because I think I was thinking about that going, oh my gosh, this, 30 years exactly.
Wow.
I know.
Julie, you look fantastic. Not a day over 29.
Oh, you. That's right. I can't keep this age forever. I just go in there. Well, but think of how much it still has to say. And it's because the story is hinging on these classic prototypes. Yeah. Or what are types of that Moby Dick and A Tale of Two Cities encapsulate so well, so that even if you don't remember it's tied to either of these, you can still appreciate it and love it. And
and Paradise Lost, you were saying, which I have not read. So you're going to have to fill me in.
I haven't read it either, but I do know the basic is that it's basically John Milton, right? Who he tells the story of Lucifer being cast from heaven. He tells the story of Lucifer, what he did to rebel against God. He's, you know, well, no, you don't have to leave, but you do have to, you know, I am God and you are not. No, you know what? I would rather reign in heaven than serve in hell. Or, I mean, sorry, other way around. Undoubtedly, he would rather reign in heaven, but would rather
reign in hell than serve in heaven, right?
Yeah, that thing. And I kind of just glanced over it. This is a professor who uses Star Trek Wrath of Khan to get the kids reading Paradise Lost interested enough in how the story works to read the poetry of it. And when she goes along and tells all this, you're just like, oh my gosh, I know they didn't write it this way, but it's that timeless conflict and the story of alienation. And do you find your way home or do you not find your way home? And she says, Kirk's ultimate lesson in the victory of life over death comes with Spock's decease. While Spock is dying, after rescuing the Enterprise in the final battle, he tells Kirk, "I never took the Kobayashi Maru test until now. What do you think of my solution?" Spock has taken the Kobayashi Maru in Kirk's place, and through sacrifice has turned the no-win situation into a triumph. As the sun accepts death for Adam and saves creation, Spock confronts death for Kirk and saves the Enterprise. Spock's demise allows Kirk ultimately to accept his own mortality as part of the unending rebirth cycle. The whole thing goes on like that. I mean, this is a really wonderful paper, and I will definitely send the link. But
I found the quote from that original Space Seed episode.
Oh, yeah.
That has
to do
with Milton. It says, Captain Kirk says, "Those men went on to tame a continent, Mr. Khan. Can you tame a world?" And Khan says, "Have you ever read Milton, Captain?" And then Kirk says, "Yes, I understand." So he never actually quoted it, but he just referred to it.
He refers to it.
He tells somebody later, somebody asks him, and he mentions the first half of that line. And I didn't.
So somebody asks him, what about Milton or something?
Somebody says, what? And he goes.
Oh, that's in The Wrath of Khan.
No, this is in Space Seed.
No, it's in Space Seed. Somebody says, what? And I think because they're like, no one's going to know what that means, okay?
That's too bad that they would have done that. They should have let it go.
Yeah.
There it is. Scotty says, it's a shame for a good Scotsman to admit it, but I'm not up on Milton. And then Captain Kirk says,
nicely done.
A statement Lucifer made when he fell into the pit. It is better to rule in hell than serve in heaven. And then Mr. Spock says, it would be interesting, Captain, to return to that world in 100 years and learn what crop has sprung from the seed you planted today.
Sequel. Well, and it's on the bookshelf. I was looking fast enough to see more than Moby Dick and Paradise Lost, but also he had in the Botany Bay. So he only has a few books.
Mm.
And the books that he has are the ones that you think are going to fuel his thinking, for one thing. And they're also classics. And I was trying to think, there was also King Lear, the Bible.
Oh, right.
Yeah, the age thing and who's going to serve or rule, I guess. And then the Bible and also Tale of Two Cities. So in case we didn't get it, they're giving us another chance.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
But I really liked that. There's always the contrast there. And then at some point, I was just to read way too much into everything. I was reading about very quickly, just a quick synopsis of themes in Moby Dick. And they were saying that the whale stands for all kinds of things. It's nebulous. It can be God. It can be... You guys may know this. I don't. And again, this was Spark Notes maybe or something. But it was saying, you know, the whale changes what it is depending on the person who's looking at it and talking about it. And I was like, that's in a sense almost Captain Kirk's situation where he's got to deal with Khan. He's got a son who's a problem. He's got this Genesis thing. He's got Spock. He's got all these things. His age, his worry about death. He's worried he's getting old. Everywhere he looks, there's a problem. It's like he can't pin it down, it seems like. I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, and in Moby Dick, you know, I think that the whale, it's just like, you know, Lord of the Rings, where the ring is whatever you're obsessing on. You know, I think that Moby Dick is kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teaching us all not to obsess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even on Star Trek.
Definitely.
No obsessing on Star Trek.
Please, no obsessing on Star Trek. I have a question about Spock's sacrifice, though.
Mm-hmm.
Something struck me, and only just, so this is not a well-formed thought at all, but is Spock's solution the equivalent of cheating the test as well? Kirk rewires it. Mm-hmm. He reprograms the simulation in order to be able to win. But from what Savick goes through in the opening sequence, it looks like the only option is you let people die in absentia, or you go in to save them and kill all of your people too.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the only options. By jumping in and sacrificing himself, isn't Spock changing the equation as well?
I know this one.
Oh,
well,
good.
Tell me. Well, no, I don't know. Well, maybe he is changing the equation, but what he's doing is it's a no-win scenario, right? One way or the other, everyone dies. He wins because he's the only one who dies. He saves everybody on the ship. The first thing he says when he hears Kirk's voice is, "The ship, is it okay?"
Right.
All right.
Which is heartbreaking. Oh my God. Talk about the sob fest beginning.
I know. You've been sitting down there going, I feel absolutely awful, you know, and he's straightening up and he's blind because he's
when he pulls his jacket down.
I know.
I know.
Nimoy is so good.
He is so good.
He knew that character so well. But that's, to me, that was the thing of he won because nobody, without that, everybody would have died. It would have been the Kobayashi Maru all over again. He's the only one who ever beat it. And not because he cheated, because he didn't cheat. He gave himself fully and willingly.
Mm-hmm. So if he had tried it
any other way, it wouldn't have worked.
So is that just the short-sightedness of the... I mean, would you put that down to the short-sightedness of the Kobayashi Maru test creators? That by not thinking far enough, if they're truly trying to create a no-win situation,
I think
there is a way to win if you think about it as saving the most people you can.
Well, but I think that they were just trying to make people face that situation and realize they couldn't win sometimes. And everybody had to face that except for Captain Kirk.
Right.
So I don't think he changed the condition. Well, okay. And as a Catholic, that's what Christ did. He did the thing nobody would have ever thought of. That's what God did. Mm-hmm. Came down and inserted himself into life with us, in between us and all the things that would turn us away from him, which would be sin, basically. And then took it all on himself and gave himself as the sacrifice to save us.
And who was it who does it in the movie? A nice Jewish boy.
Right. That's right.
How awesome is that?
With a human mother. Yeah. I just want you to remember.
And his mother.
Part human and part Vulcan. I wasn't going to go there, but thank you, Heather.
His mother is proud of her boy. He's a doctor, after all. We need to make sure everybody knows he's a good boy who loves his mother.
Well, something I did see, though, was saying that they were talking about Spock's character, and they were saying that really until this point, this could have been pushing it, and I was just glancing at it, but they were saying, in a sense, Spock was actually not whole either until he does this, because he never really comes to terms with his human side.
That's true.
Yeah.
And here he's giving way to, you know, it's not logical, although he would argue it was. I mean, he's acting on his love for all the people there.
Yeah, and that was a stroke of brilliance for the creation of Mr. Spock in the first place.
Oh, wasn't
it? To give him that tension in throughout the whole show, where he was always struggling with that. It was way more interesting than just having a cold, logical, pure Vulcan there who doesn't have that conflict inside.
Absolutely.
It wouldn't have been as interesting.
Well, and they, and then when they're having the funeral and, you know, Kirk's choking up and he's like, he was, of all my friends, he was the most human. Mm-hmm. And Savick kind of looks down, but it's when I was thinking about that point they were making, I was like, oh, well, he's finally come to terms with it.
Yeah.
He could act on both of them in harmony. It was the same goal for both sides. Mm-hmm. Logically, it worked and emotionally it worked.
Yeah.
So. Which is the thing of you go, well, I guess I could be reading so much into it. But, you know, a well-crafted story will have all that without you really consciously putting it in there, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll have things like that. So
yeah,
that's why I just it's what a entertaining movie, but.
It's a tour de force. It's a really, really well-crafted piece of entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we haven't talked about the effects. They really held up.
They did.
They really, really did. Yeah.
They really did. My kids were blown away, and they are very judge because they watch Doctor Who. And now they comment that Matt Smith's special effects are way more better than David Tennant's special effects were.
Okay.
At which point I put them in their rooms and they get no supper. And we will not diss the Tennant is what happens in this house.
But yeah, well they were taught, I think.
But they were very pleased with the special effects. Yeah. They didn't find them cheeseball at all, and I didn't
held up
either.
Very well. Yeah. Yeah. Very nice. And yeah, we discussed via email just a little bit earlier. Those were models. Mm-hmm. There was some computer in there, though. Remember, Julie, you were talking about.
Yes, lay it on us.
Yeah, the Genesis planet sequence was done by the early Pixar people. The people who eventually turned into Pixar.
It was done by Ed Catmull, who's the guy who had the dream at all of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And like six people with him or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Yes.
And it's been a while since I've read the book, but weren't they in the process of making short films at that time?
The
first thing that they did,
really,
right?
Got into this because he read that same book. I mean, he saw Ed Catmull's name and went,
yeah, it's
started
called
looking up on Wikipedia.
Yeah, the Pixar Touch, I think, is the name of the book. And the one that I read anyway.
Mm-hmm,
and I believe that at that point, if I remember right, at that point they had done this one with a baby in it.
Oh, okay.
You remember that one? And then they had started trying to make some money doing this. And I think this is one of the first jobs that they ever had. And it was, they used that little sequence to show people, to prove that this could be in a movie. And from there, Pixar was born.
Yeah, because the Genesis Project graphics were the first ones to ever go, from the computer like that to film?
Yeah.
Directly into film.
82. Yeah.
And it's just amazing what they went through. It took hours and hours of rendering. That was their biggest problem. They'd make these shapes and stuff, and then you'd have to hit render, and then you'd go home and come back and it would be done, because the computer needed that much time to deal with all that information. It's amazing how far it's come.
If you think just about the air conditioning that would have been required to keep their computers cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not joking about this. There were two moments in my adult world where I experienced shocks about my ability to recognize how far computers had come and how quickly, because we can't really tell with the desktops. It's like Microsoft Word works and it always works, so we're done.
Yeah.
There were two moments, and one was when I worked at Disney. I got to go in and watch the guys in the CGI lab build the talking tiger's head and the lava in Aladdin. And watching them do that and listening to them talk, one of the conversations was about human hair and fur. These were the things that would be impossible for 20 years.
Wow.
Mm.
It was going to be 10 or 20 years before you saw anything that could actually look like human skin or hair or anything like that. And it's not very long before the Pixar shorts start doing. There was the baby with the toys. The tin soldier one.
Mm-hmm.
And the baby skin, it does look a little creepy, but it's not bad. Mm-hmm. And then after that, everything explodes. There was that moment. And then there was teaching high school in New York City. I had a student who in 99 graduated, went to Yale. Between his freshman and sophomore year, he got to work on the Human Genome Project.
Oh.
And he was talking to me about how long it was going to take to actually map the genome. And I interviewed him years later on Craftlit when we were doing Frankenstein. I talked to him about science and stuff. And I said, I think I actually kept it in on the recording because I edited out like an hour of our just going, how are you? And how's your girlfriend? And I said to him, the genome, it's done. And it was done not long after you worked on it. What did you do? And he said, well, the size of the computers, the ability of the chips to calculate exploded right after that. And what they thought was going to take 10 years took a year.
Amazing.
Yeah. So when you kind of go, okay, well, then geometrically from Star Trek, what they were able to do with the Genesis planet being built through to the Human Genome Project. I mean, you just kind of have to step back in awe of what people have been able to do with microchips and processors and fans. I mean, the fact that your computer isn't blowing up on your desktop is it's shocking. Those things had to be really hyper air conditioned because they ran so hot.
Mm-hmm. Well, also,
we live in a brave new world.
I know, and I love
it. We do. We're holding iPads that are powerful.
Those transmitters or whatever they're called, they look so gigantic. I was like, wow, that used to look so sleek, you know, when he was talking to somebody, flip it open to talk.
I was thinking
the effects that I love the most, that I remembered loving and I still loved again, was the thing where they're in that nebula and they're suddenly going, he doesn't know how to think in three dimensions.
It's Run Silent, Run Deep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, well, and Tom made the point, he said to him, that was the most Moby Dick moment of all. He goes, because Captain Ahab would not have been able to find that whale. Mm-hmm. The whale would think about the ocean in a completely different way than Captain Ahab, and neither of us knowing anything about the book, really, other than just that. But I had never thought about it that way in terms of, you know, oh, there it is, there it is. Oh, no, I can't find it again.
Yeah, you know, they are in the ocean in that scene, and it is marvelous.
Yeah.
The way they'd shoot from above and everything.
Yeah. It did remind me of some really good World War II movies.
Yeah. Well, and that's Tom was saying. He was saying that, what was it? It was about the submarines. He goes, up until submarines, the Navy thought in two dimensions.
Mm.
He says, so that's, and that's, you know, the thing about intelligence, but a lack of experience.
Right.
You know, so where you're intelligent, you just rush right in and think you know everything. And like you were saying, that's the teenager thing in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are super smart, but you don't know everything.
Right.
So as you walk into the wall in the darkness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't know I moved it there, did you? Not that I would ever do that to my children.
Oh, wait till they're older. They're not old enough for that yet. They're not observant enough yet.
Right. Cool. All right. Well, is there anything else?
Man.
Montalban's chest. Did we talk about his chest?
Yeah, when does the chest make its first appearance? Yeah.
Leave it to Heather.
Yes.
No, that was a running joke.
I have heard that it was his real chest.
That's what Nimoy says.
Yep.
I trust Nimoy.
Nimoy
on the
too.
Record.
Yep.
So I was watching more closely this time, and I was like, yeah, you know, it kind of moves like an actual chest when he's sitting there kind of moving, not with his shoulders back and sitting up proudly, but when he's kind of leaning forward and thinking, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's closer to an old man chest right over there. So, yeah, okay.
I figured they wouldn't have put him in a costume like that if they hadn't been able to exploit his natural assets. I don't think that's a costume you would fabricate.
Right.
For an entire film, maybe a scene, but that would have been a real stretch for a special effects crew to make a chest.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah, I agree.
I'm sure it was enhanced by spray paint. You know, the spray shadowing and stuff.
I allow none of it. No, it was him.
It's mine. And my
That's right. It's my chest to look at. You just keep your spray paint off of it. But I did love the way that he trod, I guess, that fine line of chewing the scenery and excellent acting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he was over the top, he had built up to it so much, you'd believe anything of this guy.
Yeah.
And to me, anyway, because I always look at it and go, well, maybe he's just so over the top. And I'm like, I don't care. I embrace it.
Yeah, without question, it worked.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and that's a trick that so many actors these days, especially on stage, it's like if you start off screaming, you got nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start quiet. It's like Ursula in The Little Mermaid.
Jeez, as a matter of fact.
She has to start off very charming and nice so that you would believe that people would make the mistake of going to her when they needed help.
Yes. Regardless. Innocent young girls.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying.
Yep. That's right. Well, what about you, Scott? Anything else?
I don't know. I think we covered everything.
What do you think of Ricardo Montalban's chest?
It's not as impressive as mine. But yeah.
Now, was it just me also who was watching this thinking I did not realize how much of Galaxy Quest came from this particular movie?
Galaxy Quest is a great movie.
Yeah.
What a great movie that is. But no, I didn't realize I'd have to watch it again and with that in mind. But it came from so much. Great movie. Well,
and it did. It's brilliant in a whole different way. But I was thinking the part where, they're going into the nebula. Well, they have instead that minefield. but it's the same concept, basically. And the fierce commander who, you don't have a choice. You're going to do what I want. Well, that's like the alien that they're facing in Galaxy Quest. And the fact that they're completely unprepared for what's going on, even though it's for a different reason. That's this ship when it meets the first ship, because they're just, thinking it's a joke. And I just looked at it and just went, wow. And Tom's like, oh yeah, this episode, it's like this movie, it's like they took it and went, this is a good basic story. Let's work with it.
That's good stuff.
So.
Need to see Galaxy Quest again.
Yep. Funny movie. Funny, funny movie.
Oh, yes.
And what a great cast, too. I mean, that sucker is. That is an excellent cast.
Let's get out of here before someone kills Guy. Oh, I love it. There's how you can explain what a red shirt is.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's true.
Yeah. So cool. Well, all right. I think we've covered it.
I know. Thank you for choosing that movie, Scott.
Well, geez, thank you. That was awesome.
thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Really great. Really great.
Now, let's see. Next, we'll be doing Coraline.
Coraline by Neil Gaiman, the book.
Yep, which I read because because Jesse kept pushing it at me for SFF Audio for talking about the new mother. And I resisted because I didn't like the first part of the book. And I was so happy I did that I'm making us read it.
Excellent. I've read it, so I will read it again. I'm looking forward to it.
Yep.
A book that Gaiman said makes adults uncomfortable, but kids really like.
I think that sums it up.
Yep.
And another Jewish boy, Neil Gaiman.
That's right. Who understands story really well.
That's right.
And he knows his Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. but I listened to him read it, and of course that made all the difference too, because he's just such a wonderful
He's one
narrator.
Of those authors that can narrate so well.
Oh, yeah.
I always say Neil Gaiman and Harlan Ellison is another one that I think narrates is just perfectly.
I have not listened to that Harlan Ellison you sent me yet, but surely I will
pick
soon.
A story sometime and just, he's
and
great.
And then the next movie will be Rear Window.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Yeah, summer will be starting. I didn't just plan it that way, but I just was like, oh, this is going to be good timing.
That is, that's going to work out really good. So when... After May 17th, what's 2 weeks after that? Let's see, 20...
See, it's the 30th, so I don't know if
May
you'll be...
May 30th? But. Yeah, doable.
Okay.
So
okay, good.
Yeah, we're moving the week after that.
Oh, okay, right. Because I don't know if you've mentioned this to people who listen. Job and everything.
I'm starting my own business.
Yeah.
And I'm moving to Idaho Falls, Idaho. So if you're in Idaho Falls, Idaho, hello. I'm on my way.
I know. The big city.
The big city, yeah, for me. The big city. Yeah, I live in a town that's got about 3,500 people in it.
Oh, so
and
small.
I'm moving to one that's got, I think about 50,000 is where it's sitting. 50 or 60,000. So it's still not big compared to where you guys live.
No, but it sounds like the perfect size in a sense. I mean, you still can have countryside around you, fairly accessible, but you can have things like, Barnes & Noble and...
Yeah, exactly. And movies.
Right
now it's a 45-mile drive for a movie.
Oh, and a Catholic church with its own priest.
Holy cow. Can you imagine going to church on Sundays? It'll be good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have the traveling priest now. I mean,
Yep. All true.
Exciting.
All true.
All that stuff. McDonald's, so, everything.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I know. I'm so excited for you.
Fingers crossed. I'm excited to get after it. I know it's going to be hard work, but time to do it.
Yeah. Well, and the great thing is, though, your kids are a little bit older. They are excited, too.
My oldest is graduating high school.
Yeah.
And then I've only got one other who's 11. So she's going into seventh grade next year. So it's a pretty good time for her. She's a little nervous, but happy. Mm-hmm. I think, she's happy for the change too. And we, have family in Idaho Falls. So we're not going to a place that we don't know. And so she knows people there already. So.
Oh, perfect.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So a little fantastic. Nervous, but happy.
I know. You can have her get on Skype with my 11-year-old and the two of them can compare notes on going to middle school.
Oh, that's great.
Someplace where they don't know a lot of people.
That would be fantastic. Yeah.
Well, that's right. You moved that timing too, didn't you?
We did. We did. And,
it worked out well, I hope.
It has worked out very well. And I'll tell you the truth. I moved in seventh grade from Southern California to Arizona. And it was scary, but it worked out really, really well.
Oh, good. Excellent.
Yeah,
glad to hear that. Yep.
I was only slightly traumatized, and I got over it very quickly.
And your kick butt
a little
now.
Trauma's okay.
And I still love my parents, and we get along great.
Fantastic.
Okay, Scott, you're set.
All good. Yeah.
All good. All great.
All right. Well, thanks again, you two.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
And we'll see
all
you folks out there in wherever you're at in a couple of weeks. Yep.
In 2 weeks. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.